Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We begin with a very simple question. How did we get here?
No one really knows how the game is played. The art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens.
Once upon a time, the U.S. House of Representatives was steeped in tradition. Its speaker all-powerful. Its leaders paid up on long tabs of seniority and political favors to get to the top. So how did a few dozen rookie lawmakers from the South and Midwest manage to topple John Boehner and Kevin McCarthy?
I want to be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
In this case, the room where it happened was the place where the so-called Freedom Caucus first decided to challenge everything traditional about the House. Republican John Fleming is a representative from Louisiana.
We want to hear what they want to do creatively and innovatively to begin taking back the powers that are guaranteed to the U.S. Congress through the Constitution.
Fleming is unafraid of confronting the Speaker or anyone else because he comes from a safe district. All of the Freedom Caucus Republicans do. Fleming's district in Louisiana was iffy back in 2008. He won by a slim majority over his Democratic rival. By 2010, though, the district was re-engineered to have a solid majority by fellow Republicans in the Louisiana legislature. In the 2010 election, Fleming won by a landslide, and by 2012, he was running unopposed, taking the 4th district with 75% of the vote over an independent Libertarian candidate. All 36 members of the Freedom Caucus started out as ideological soulmates. Many of them rode to Congress with the support of the Tea Party movement in 2010 and 2012. But now, because of this nationwide district re-engineering, they command fearless majorities in their own districts. They are not going anywhere. Hedrick Smith is executive editor of ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. He says that winning national office may be difficult for the GOP, but for a relatively small amount of money, he says the Republican Party has been able to buy a valuable insurance policy, control of Congress through strategic redistricting.
After losing the presidency to Barack Obama in 2009, Karl Rove, the Republican campaign guru, said he who controls redistricting can't control Congress, and he was smart. They invested $30 million in the legislative campaigns, state legislative campaigns, way down the ballot that most of the media doesn't even pay any attention to. And they went after the control of as many legislatures as they could. They picked up 675 seats nationwide. It left them with control of both the governorship and both houses of the state legislature in states that control 40% of the seats in the House of Representatives. And then in 2011, they proceeded to do a massive job of redistricting on a partisan basis, what we call the gerrymander, using very sophisticated modern computer software. And they carved up the nation. And in seven really critical states, they tilted the results. They actually had a popular vote in seven key states. It was almost the same as the Democrats, slightly more. They should have given them one or two more seats. And they came out with 19 seats. If you change those 19 seats, the Republicans would not have had the majority of the House in 2012. I'm not saying it would have worked automatically to give the Democrats control, but the Democrats did win the popular vote nationwide. And the Republicans walked away with a 33-seat majority. And the Republicans themselves will chortle and say, yeah, we did it through redistricting.
If you could use a local or regional example, show how the red map remap changed the game enough to either determine the legislative election in a state or, change a congressional district, et cetera.
Well, take the state of North Carolina, which has historically been a state dominated by, at the state level, the governor and the state legislature by the Democrats, even though they've had Republican senators like Jesse Helms and others. What they did was the Democrats controlled the redistricting of the state's congressional districts back in 2001 after the 2000 census, and they got a slight majority of the popular vote. There are 13 districts in North Carolina. 7 of them were Democrat and 6 of them were Republican. Pretty well reflected the party registration of people in that state and the way people lived. After the 2010 election, the Republicans took control of both the governorship and the state legislature. They did a redistricting. And the Democrats, once again in the 2012 election, won a majority of the popular vote. But the Republicans came out with 9 seats and the Democrats with 4. That's a shift of 3 seats. And nobody moved around. I mean, there are a lot of political scientists who will say, and even some campaign experts who will say, look, this is just the big sort. Democrats live in cities. Republicans live in the suburbs and the rural areas. It's just the way we all live. There's nothing you can do about it. Well, that's baloney. I mean, if you look at North Carolina, there was no shift in population. And after a Republican redistricting, the Republicans picked up 3 seats.
Is Florida the worst example here?
I think Florida is one of the worst examples. There are 6 members of this Republican rebellion group that come from Florida. It was the Florida voters passed a constitutional referendum in 2010 saying you could not have a partisan gerrymander that was intended to favor one party over another. The legislature totally ignored it. The governor totally ignored it. And Common Cause and the League of Women Voters and other people filed a lawsuit. And the courts have finally said, Florida Supreme Court has said the gerrymandering of 2011 in Florida was unconstitutional. They've ordered the redrawing of district lines. One of the courts has just done it, and they've changed at least 8 districts. And it looks as though in at least 3 seats, the incumbent is going to be vulnerable if not thrown out. And one of them, interestingly enough, is this guy Daniel Webster, who is one of the leaders of the rebellion in the House among the Freedom Caucus. He's the guy they've put forward as their candidate for speaker. His district has been totally dismantled, and Webster says, I can't win in the new district. So the point here is that gerrymander reform could actually fix this problem. It's got to be taken up in a bunch of states, Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, the states I mentioned, and others. And it is starting to happen, John. There actually are public movements. There are lawsuits being filed in Maryland, Wisconsin, Texas, Alabama, a lot of places. So there is a lot of change going on, which is basically being ignored by the media. I think there's a feeling here among the mainstream media that gerrymandering is an old-fashioned problem, politics 101, let's get modern, forget it. I think they're missing a point here. This is basic stacking the deck in your favor, and it's up to the people and lawsuits to fix it. And in at least 20 states, people are doing something about it, which is amazing.
Hedrick Smith is executive editor of ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. Thanks so much.
John, great to be with you. Thanks.
Our next guest generously agreed to speak with us in advance of his meeting with President Obama. Rick Ramish is executive director of the Colorado Department of Corrections and a founding member of the group Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime. That group is meeting with the president today. Rick Ramish, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
You were very impressed with the president's visit to a prison and his thoughtful comments when he did visit. What would you want to tell him about what it looks like in perhaps one of the facilities you would most like to reform?
Well, what I would like to offer is an invitation for him to come to the state of Colorado and see what we're doing within our systems as far as segregation reform and how that can be, I believe, successfully implemented nationwide.
When you say segregation reform, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is, for instance, in Colorado in 2011, approximately 1,500 people, or almost 7% of our prison population, was in what we call administrative segregation, or call it solitary confinement, call it the hole, call it restrictive housing, call it whatever you want, but it's basically individuals being isolated in a 7-by-13-foot cell 23 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we've reduced that population to less than 1% of our population, and no longer put anybody that's seriously mentally ill into segregation, and nor do we release anybody directly from segregation into the community.
What is the impact of releasing people directly from solitary into the community, and what is the impact not only on the person who has to face just this incredible culture shock, but also law enforcement.
Well, what I've said cynically is, why don't we just, if we're doing that, why don't we just stamp return to prison on their forehead and let them out? It's not a good way of doing business, obviously. We haven't done it for over 18 months. And my thoughts on that, as we discussed it with our staff, is that, you know, the overuse of segregation basically was used to run institutions more efficiently. To do that, that meant that instead of just violent people being placed into segregation, it was those that maybe shot their mouths off, maybe broke some minor rules, were put into segregation under a system that basically didn't allow them to work their way out. And that's how they ended up spending years in these facilities. And what I explained to our staff and what we talked about was that running an efficient institution is a noble goal, but that's not what our mission is. Our mission is community safety, and we've lost sight of our mission, so we stopped doing that.
Rick Ramish is executive director of the Colorado Department of Corrections. This is The Takeaway. How does mental health and the need for mental health care in the prison system bear on the reforms that you're envisioning?
You can't really talk about segregation reform without addressing the mentally ill. You know, every one of us in my position and those that run county jails, we all stood up, and deservedly so, and we slammed our fist on the podium and said that, and we run the largest mental health systems in our state, and we do. But then what I had to do is look in the mirror each morning and say, okay, and now that we're doing that, what am I doing with them? And unfortunately, when you look into the mirror, you understand that in a lot of instances, because the mentally ill are disruptive within institutions, they end up in segregation. And so what we've done is we have two facilities that are dedicated to the mentally ill, their treatment, and we basically have stopped the use of segregation in those facilities. And actually, the positive results are tremendous.
Finally, Mr. Ramish, if you were to give me a kind of ballpark gut feeling about where this reform could go, I mean, if you could wave your magic wand and go into your most crowded institutions and take the mentally ill who clearly need to be in some sort of clinical setting, take the people who you could look straight in the eye and say, I can see a pathway for these people to go back to the community safely. And then the violent people who you understand are clearly a threat to the community, a threat to community safety. How much would that shrink your population, do you think, in the state of Colorado, if you could do that tomorrow?
Well, let me give you a little bit of data. About 34 to 36% of our total inmate population are suffering from some type of mental problem. 14 to 18% of those individuals have severe mental illness. And so just that figure alone drop our numbers substantially. To simplify things again, you know, what we've talked about is we have to determine who's bad and who we're simply mad at. And the ones we're simply mad at, it's maybe time to find another alternative for them. And that would mean the nonviolent offenders, of course.
Who came up with that? The people who are bad and the people we're simply mad at? Because that seems to get to the crux of this whole crime problem in the United States as we try to pivot here.
You know, I really wish I could take credit for that, but I can't. When I first heard that sentence, it really struck home with me, and I thought that's the answer. That really simplifies things, and that's what we have to do.
That's brilliant. Figure out the difference between who we're mad at and who's bad.
Correct.
You going to tell that to the president?
If I get the opportunity, I sure would like to.
Rick Ramish is executive director of the Colorado Department of Corrections. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Perhaps he was trying to get attention. Perhaps he or she was trying to get a job at Google. A hacker, reportedly younger than 20 and now under investigation by the FBI, claimed responsibility along with two others for the breach of CIA Chief John Brennan's email account late last week. WikiLeaks has started to release some of the information. One clue as to how easy this might have been for a hacker comes from John Brennan's reported email, hopefully changed by now, an old AOL account. David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, joins us. David, welcome.
Good to be back with you, John.
Bad for Brennan, not so bad for American security. Is that the verdict here?
Well, you know, if you think about the breaches of the past 6 months, poor Mr. Brennan has had the form that you fill out for your national security clearance, and he must have filled this out before he joined the White House in his previous job before he was the CIA director back in 2009. He's had it breached twice now this year. Once when the Chinese got into the Office of Personnel Management's computer systems and took out the records of 22 million Americans, about 7% of the population, including, we assume, Mr. Brennan's form. And then again, when Verizon and AOL fell for some trick to these hackers and basically gave away his password. So, you know, it's hard to get internet security around these days, even if you're CIA director.
And is there any sense from the WikiLeaks material that Brennan was responsible or particularly irresponsible, very discreet with the kinds of things that he was sharing in this email account?
So far, the documents that we have seen that WikiLeaks have posted have been profoundly boring. They include this security form, which has very little new on it, but WikiLeaks did not delete the social security numbers and so forth of his family members and so forth. So I'm sure there's a bit of a scramble right now to go clean up from that. There were a few essays and documents he had written, which we discovered on brief search had already been published elsewhere as basically journal articles about what to do with Iran, written in 2008 before he was in government in 2009. So there is absolutely nothing that we have seen of any kind of secure nature here. So it's a very different story than, say, the contention that the State Department has had that some of the emails that Hillary Clinton received on her private email account had classified material on it. Perhaps there was some, but so far we haven't seen any.
What does this say about the security of operational details? I mean, would they be on separate email accounts based on what we're looking at from Brennan here? The operational stuff seems to be somewhere else.
Yeah, this is his private email account. It's his AOL account. And as I wrote a day or two ago, perhaps the most embarrassing revelation to him here is that he was still using AOL when most of his friends probably had moved on. But a lot of people who have AOL accounts over the years have just held on to them in time. There was no significant government data that we have seen so far on what's been released. I think there is a very big question, though, about a reasonable question which Mr. Brennan could raise in public about not only having better internet security for individuals, we're told to change their passwords and use two-factor authentication, but also for Verizon and AOL and other internet providers who clearly fell for an easy trick here and turned over his sensitive data.
Absolutely. David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Always a pleasure, David.
Good to be with you, John.
Vandalism or a chilling reminder of America's racial past? Authorities in St. Louis say a series of fires at seven predominantly black churches in the region are linked in an area that's become a national focal point for issues of racial tension. The fires were set when the churches were empty and there have been no injuries reported. Officials are offering a $9,000 reward for any information that leads to the arrest of those responsible. Reverend Roderick K. Burton is the pastor of New Northside Missionary Baptist Church, where a fire broke out at the front door about a week and a half ago. Reverend, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What is your feeling about what's going on in the community right now?
I'm troubled, very concerned for this, you know, series of events. Especially I'm very concerned at whether things will continue or escalate.
And is this someone trying to trigger something? What do you think's happening here? Because it does seem as though these are related. The authorities say that these events are related.
I think, again, this is just my opinion, that it's someone who's having a mental situation the nature of the attacks are, you know, it's kind of amateur hour, and I'm very grateful for that. But I feel like it's someone who is acting out against the churches for whatever reason. At the end, that I feel like that's what they'll find out.
Amateur hour, your choice of those words. That's interesting because it sounds like you've thought through this carefully rather than emotionally.
Well, with the exception of the church that I just found out about, the seventh church that was burned, I went to every location to take pictures and to leave a letter of, you know, showing our solidarity. And just by looking at what had been done, they all seemed to be just kind of like a not a very well thought out, you know, not a very intent attack. But in the case of the fifth church, there was catastrophic damage because just the nature of, you know, fire. So I'm hoping it stops, first of all, but as they continue, I'm just hoping they don't get any more sophisticated.
What was the mood at the vigil that you were at last night, and what was the turnout of the community?
The turnout was, it really overwhelmed me. I was surprised. The church was packed, and many people from the community and from the faith community showed up, even people who didn't describe the faith. They showed up to show their solidarity. They were concerned about someone messing with our freedom, the right to have religion and practice it or not practice it.
Did that say that the St. Louis area has moved forward in its ability to respond responsibly to these kinds of events? Or what does it say about how history has changed in St. Louis in the last year?
Well, at first I was very troubled because you know, I'd been on television for about a week, the local media, trying to get the word out, trying to wake people up, and it seemed like there was just a big apathy. I didn't know whether it was Ferguson fatigue, but seems as if, starting with the black, because even the black community was a little bit lethargic in responding, but now it seems as if the community is rallying together, and that's very hopeful. We will see whether there's any legs, and I did challenge those who were at the service yesterday to be intentional about continuing to reach out to any victims and also being intentional about looking out for one another as a community.
And that's blacks and whites, and that's just projecting that we're all together in this, not we're all in our little enclaves.
Absolutely, John. That, unfortunately, that has been a very tragic history. St. Louis always comes down as one of the most racially divided cities. And at some point, in order to push past that, people need to be intentional. And I challenged the faith community as a faith leader that we needed to be leaders. And this tragic series of events could be an opportunity to turn that around.
Well, I wish I could be there with you this Sunday. I was in St. Louis just a week or so ago, it was great to speak with so many community leaders. Reverend Burton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like Russian, retirement planning, and rock climbing. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI. Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Storms of competing histories have raged over the Middle East for decades. Depending on who you talk to, Israel's claim to its land comes from biblical prophecy or as part of a political settlement to a Jewish migration problem in Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries, or as the settlement of a war between Jews and Arabs in 1948. Conversations with Palestinians produce parallel contrasts of history, prophecy, and politics, all mixed together. Amidst a new wave of violence in the Middle East, as the prospect dims for any settlement of issues that have been around since 1948 or 1967 or 1973, tensions have once again begun to rise. And this week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu evoked one of the most powerful historical narratives, the Holocaust, to link the slaughter of Jews in Europe to an idea allegedly given to Adolf Hitler by the Muslim Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. The Mufti had his own Jewish problem, Netanyahu said, and gave Hitler a suggestion.
Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at the time. He wanted to expel the Jews. And Haji Amin al-Husseini went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll all come here. So what should I do with them? He asked. You said, burn them.
Joining us is Gabriel Rosenfeld, author of High Hitler, How the Nazi Past is Being Normalized in Contemporary Culture. He's a professor of history at Fairfield University. Comment on what Netanyahu has said historically here. Is it accurate?
Unfortunately, it's inaccurate. And the consensus of most historians, of course, is that Adolf Hitler had already come to the perspective that getting rid of the Jews through mass murder was the preferred policy. Most historians argue that by the summer, if not mid-fall of 1941, he had already abandoned a policy of mass deportation of the Jews to Central Asia in the interior of the Soviet Union and had settled upon a policy of mass murder.
So describe now the temptation of Israeli leaders, of all kinds of leaders in the Middle East, to use the Holocaust in various ways to make political points.
The Holocaust, of course, is the central tragedy and trauma of the Jewish people in the modern era. And for the founders of the State of Israel, of course, it was an event that had to be addressed in all kinds of varieties of political discourse, whether it's David Ben-Gurion, who in the early 1960s approved of the kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann and his transport to Israel to stand trial for crimes against the Jewish people, or whether it's Menachem Begin comparing Yasser Arafat during the Lebanon War in the early 1980s to Hitler. It's a constant temptation. It's just in this case, Netanyahu, I think, is guilty of rhetorical overstretch because at the level of causality, Hitler really didn't need Haji Amin al-Husseini to propose anything about killing the Jews. He had already settled upon that policy himself.
Do you think the Holocaust narrative and evocations of the Holocaust narrative put the brakes on that, that it's very easy for Israeli leaders to evoke the Holocaust for one reason or another and stop any kind of overtures towards negotiation and peace because it is such an easy button to push?
I think, unfortunately, that is the case. Not all examples of invoking the Holocaust are purely instrumentalized or are purely opportunistic. I do think that, for example, within Israeli society, there is a decent percentage of the population that has been afraid that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, that the prospect of a quote-unquote second Holocaust might be in the offing. Although, of course, it's very tempting for politicians to incite certain feelings in their populations by harping upon these kinds of issues. And so when Benjamin Netanyahu was at the United Nations talking about we're 5 minutes before midnight and a second Holocaust is in the offing, that doesn't exactly de-escalate the discourse in the Middle East. And of course, for both sides, to try and come to any kind of mutually agreed upon settlement, the rhetoric has to be dialed down quite a bit.
Does that rhetoric invite on the other side, people saying, oh, this Holocaust is a big exaggeration, and then the deniers come out of the woodwork?
Absolutely. And one of the ironies, of course, is that already not only people on the anti-Zionist front, but also Israelis, who would be, of course, very much in support of Zionism, have already been comparing Netanyahu to a Holocaust denier and as someone who is whitewashing Hitler and, in a sense, normalizing, if not rehabilitating him by claiming that up until the Grand Mufti suggested mass murder, he was taking a softer policy of mass deportation.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
How changeable is this narrative? As time goes on, you know, you have Mel Brooks playing around with, is this the moment that we can actually make jokes about Hitler, which is what, you know, his whole first movie was about and then the revival with the Broadway show was about. And then, of course, this novel in Germany that's done so well that casts Hitler as a time-traveling talk show host.
It's interesting that you point this out. In my book, one of the things I was trying to alert readers to is the fact that the discourse that you see right now about Hitler in the Middle East and, frankly, the kind of comments that have also been way off base by Ben Carson about gun control, these kinds of examples of what I would call the universalization of the Nazi past, whereby various observers try and draw lessons for the present-day world from what allegedly was going on in the Third Reich, that's the other side of the coin of what you just were alluding to in terms of the comedic turn in terms of how the Nazi past is being addressed these days. So whether it's The Producers, which of course in the late 60s was a smash film, whether you're talking about the novel Look Who's Back in Germany, which is also now a film, or other films like Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, which has a very clear satirical streak to it, or the endless number of Hitler memes on the World Wide Web, whether it's catsthatlooklikehitler.com or Hipster Hitler, that's sort of the other example of what I would call normalization these days. It's completely losing sight of the ethical and moral lessons and the specificity of the Third Reich for the sake of making jokes and aestheticizing this period of history. And whether it's aestheticization or whether it's universalization, my basic argument, I suppose, is that the further away we get from the Nazi past and as the eyewitnesses die off, we are basically seeing the images of the Third Reich being created by people who play fast and loose with the facts and, frankly, don't have much knowledge about the specific historical reality, but they're opportunistically instrumentalizing this past for their own purposes.
Time is not on the side of truth in this case.
No, and of course, tragedy plus time equals comedy, as we're often told. And so the question is, as we lose sight of the historical reality of the Third Reich, we're going to probably see more and more of these kinds of reckless comparisons being made. And then we need to get to the fact checkers and have a nice discussion about who's right and who's wrong. And in one sense, I suppose that does keep the past alive. But one would hope that we could have an agreed upon factual basis of what actually happened and not waste our time trying to debunk false representations of the historical record.
Gabriel Rosenfeld is author of High Hitler, How the Nazi Past is Being Normalized in Contemporary Culture. He's a professor of history at Fairfield University. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.